today is gonna be the day that they're gonna throw it back to you. By now you should have somehow realized what you gotta do. I don't believe that anybody feels the way I do about you now.
Radio Gorgeous, created by women for women. RadioGorgeous.com.
Today will be different. Is the story of Eleanor Flood, a woman who lives in Seattle, who wakes up determined to be the best version of herself. She sets the bar very low and just wants to be kind, wants to be present, wants to love her son and husband well, and then life happens.
And some days just doing that does seem difficult.
Indeed. Well, she certainly doesn't come near pulling it off, so it's impossible for her.
But somehow it occurred to me that that is a very normal thing that we do. That, you know, you sit there in yoga, and it's almost as if we swallowed, you know, like Stuart Smalley's, like, daily affirmations. Like, I'm going to be good enough, I'm going to be smart enough, and gosh darn it, people are going to like me.
Yes.
And we somehow swallowed those. And thought, like, that's how we should be, as opposed to, you know, it's kind of like this yawning gap between how it looks and how it's lived.
Indeed. And I think the Stuart Smalley thing kind of gets to one of, I think, the themes in the book, which is that in the beginning of the novel, Eleanor is saying today will be different. Today will be different. And that's, you know, the jacket of the book. It has it all written over and over and over, almost like she's protesting too much. You know that if she's just saying it over and over with such force and such self-will, then inherently there's some kind of problem, that's not how it happens. You know, happiness doesn't happen with the crowbar. You know, and I think that she's really trying to force herself into being a person who I don't think she can be by force.
And sort of, you know, like her mantra is her mantra. My mantra is to have a mantra, and therefore I will be happy.
Very much so, yes. One of the things I believe the book is it's an accurate depiction of how hard moment-to-moment kind of microtransactions can be and how painful they can be. You know, and if you just are wanting to be kind to someone and then you find that you're not kind, or you want to be present and you find that you're not present, that there's actually an enormous amount of suffering just going through the banalities of life. And so at least I certainly feel that way. And I really committed to that as a stance with Eleanor. And so I am finding with readers and early readers that really taps into something, that they go, finally, someone is acknowledging that even a life that does, quote unquote, look easy on the outside, or, oh, I should be lucky to have your problems, you know, which I really think is my readership. I mean, I think that really, if you look at the state of the world, pretty much anyone with a $25 hardcover in their hands is having rich person's problems, you know, in some
Absolutely.
Ways that has time to read novels and all of this stuff, which doesn't mean that we don't suffer and doesn't mean that there's not kind of an interior life that causes us pain.
And I do think it is a good impulse to want to be better, at the very least. You know, it's like, you know, it's not like taking, well, you know, sort of like Popeye, I am what I am, you know, like whatever, you know, so I'm an asshole, deal with it. You know, she at least does, you know, have the desire.
Oh, very much so. And I think that's one of my rules, kind of, when I write women or basically anyone, my main heroines are women, but I feel like a lot of times people want to know if I'm concerned with characters being sympathetic or likable, and all I'm really interested in is the character trying? Because I think if someone is trying, then they are inherently sympathetic. Then you're immediately on their side, because to try is to make yourself vulnerable. And it also means that it's kind of fun to see if it's going to work out or not. Then just on kind of a story level, the reader is like, oh, that's what they want. That's their way of going about to get it. I don't think it's a good idea, but let's just see how it works out, you know? And then as the author, it's up to me to kind of make the anticipation fun.
Yes. Well, and also the more they stumble, the funnier it is for us.
Very much so, yes. The more it's, we're glad it's not us who's making those mistakes.
Right, we can point and laugh.
Exactly. Look at how she's doing it. Yeah, I would never do something like that. Yes.
And of course, those you know, middle class, for middle-aged women problems are hugely highlighted with children, ideas around work, and marriage. And in each of those, she's got the squirmiest, you know, most uncomfortable moments and fears. And those things, and especially around children and husbands, there's also what you very seamlessly manage to illuminate is the competitiveness mixed with a little self-loathing.
Certainly, yes, you know. A little, yes.
a dash of this, a dash of that.
Yes, yes.
And it's the perfect recipe for just, you know, putting herself through paroxysms of sort of self-torture.
Yes. Well, I think that one of the reasons why I decided to write this book, or why this book kind of needed to be written as far as I was concerned, is I do find myself every night going to sleep regretting the way that I was with my partner and my daughter, you know, thinking, oh, she wanted to play a board game, and instead I was just looking at celebrity gossip on the internet and said okay later, and then it was time for bed and I never played the board game with her, which just makes me sick even to speak about it, you know. And that's a day you can never get back, and they grow up, and what we all know, you know. And the same way with my partner, you know, that he wants to be loved and to be paid attention to and to be the focus of my attention. And a lot of times I take him for granted as almost kind of an afterthought or something that's getting in my way. And that's really what, you know, I try to capture in the book, and to have that be kind of the resting state, kind of where we begin, as Eleanor is just kind of taking her husband for granted, you know, happy to just kind of pawn the kid off on someone else. And through the course of the day, she does kind of, I think, start to, there's a shift that takes place, you know, that where I think she, of course, realizes, oh, I should be doing better. But I think that maybe a shift happens and she will do better.
Yes. I think, as I say, a miracle is a shift in perception.
Oh, that's a good saying. I love that. Yes, so miracles happen.
Shift.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
A little shift in perception. You know,
very much so. That's
throughout
good.
The book. One of the things I really loved you bringing up, and again, the book is exuberant and funny, and a lot of the situations ridiculous and over the top, but sometimes that happens, and also it doesn't matter. It adds to the story, the journey, etc. But one of the things you actually tackle, I think in a very nice way, is the subject of religion, which is like the new dirty word.
Oh, indeed. And that's kind of why it was so attractive to me, is I feel like I do have a pretty hip knowing perspective. And I think that in general, I think I present the world in this very kind of atheistic way, you know, with just like highly educated, neurotic characters. And so I thought when I thought about introducing religion, it seems so square to me and so just radioactive in terms of who I am as a writer that I just knew I had to go for it. I was like, oh man, why did I even think of that? Because now I'm going to have to make it work. And what's important is that I didn't want to just, you know, take shots at it, you know, is that I did take it very seriously, and I do take it very seriously. And I think, you know, a lot of people talk about, oh, what did you learn from the book? And really my answer is always nothing. That it doesn't leave me in a different person, in a different place, or make me a different person to write a book. But I really think I'm proud the most of the way that I gave Christianity, which, look, let's just call it what it is, because Buddhism is okay. You know, there's a lot of religion that's okay, but Christianity, it's like run like the wind from anyone who starts talking about Jesus. You know, it is like such a buzzkill. And so for me to take that seriously and to give it real respect and real compassion, I'm really proud that I did that. And I genuinely feel that way. And that really was a shift in my own perception.
I would say, and I think it's actually important in public discourse right now to do that, because I see it in the States and I see it here. There's a real black and white view of the Muslim religion, mm-hmm. and that's getting scary.
Yes.
And while it's not scary, you know, to me, obviously if I were a Christian in Egypt, maybe it would
yes.
be, Christianity would be, you know, that would feel scary. But as an American, as in living in Europe, Europeans, being Christian isn't scary. But it could easily get that way too. And it's a really good way to just recheck in with that.
Yes.
There's a lot of people. Maybe we should look at that and maybe not just be as dismissive.
Right. And I think that the book really starts out just kind of globally dismissive towards religion. And I think what, and also the way I chose to go into it was kind of the historical Jesus, you know, and to really try to strip down Christianity to what we know historically, to the extent that we do know anything. But I did a lot of research on that, and I basically brought we won't talk too much, we've already talked a lot about it, but the character who does find religion, I only brought their embrace of it as far as I feel like I could personally embrace it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Is that just kind of the message, the message of the historical Jesus and the historical context of what a radical message it was, and how you really do have to pay that respect. You can't dismiss that. Like that to the extent that that is true, it's a really radical act of love. What he was representing. And sure, you can write off, oh, the religious right, and oh, the nut jobs, the Christian morons who are all voting for Trump, or I don't even know if they're voting for Trump, but they're probably sitting it out, which is really bad. Christians vote for Hillary. Anyway, don't sit this one out. But it's very easy to dismiss them. And yeah. So I'm glad that I kind of took it seriously and only brought it up to the level that I personally was comfortable with.
You have a face for radio. Radio gorgeous, that is. Another thing that you address is having and explore and discuss is having a very chaotic childhood. And there's a sibling relationship born of a very chaotic childhood, which is both and also in my personal experience, I have felt this twinning, that it is both forming a tight bond as well as a wedge.
Mm.
Because you were sort of in a pressure cooker and left to your own devices, there's something that later in life not wanting to be witnessed about that.
Yeah, well, I always found it interesting how if you have kind of a harrowing childhood, that just looking around, that there are people who it either brings them together or it drives them apart. And it's really interesting. Certainly the driving the people apart is almost counterintuitive. You know, you would think, oh, you're the only person who really understands what I went through and who knows me better than anybody. But I actually think the norm is that you have adult siblings who don't like each other, who don't want to know each other, who when they grow up, they think, wow, that's the only thing we have in common is our parents, and I'm just a different human being right now, and you would not be my friend right now, and you have your interests or not my interests, so why would I spend time with you?
I wouldn't choose you.
Exactly, I wouldn't choose you, and so, you know, now that the parents are dead, can we just, you know, shake hands and just go our own ways, you know, so you see that a lot. And so, yeah, I'm very interested in that. I'm very interested in adult siblings because you think you can leave it at the door at a certain point, but you never can. I mean, I'm in my 50s and I'm still having these kind of mini dramas, you know, with my siblings. And one of the reasons really why I thought I would include it, this whole kind of area in my novel, is that after my father died 2 or 3 years ago, was right when I was starting the book, and I was entangled in family stuff, as we all are. Of course, deaths, you know, kind of bring that stuff out. And I was complaining about somebody or something. I can't even remember what the situation was, but I was going on and on. And my boyfriend, George, just said, "Will you shut up about it already? My God, just stop talking about it." And I said, "You don't understand. They're my family." And he said, "I'm your family." And it was this kind of shocking moment where I thought, oh my gosh, I'm actually identifying. And I think, honestly, I do identify as a Semple, as that family, as opposed to my new family. You know, I have a 12-year-old daughter, so it's not even like it's new to me. It's just so primal that I feel still kind of entangled in that family. And those are my entanglements, you know. And maybe that goes for everybody, that even as an adult, you're there, you know, obsessing over fights you have with your siblings or your parents, or, oh, one thing I want to say to them, or, oh, I should have said that, or, you know, it kind of does bring you to that place, you know.
For years.
Yeah, for years, you know. And so I just thought that was an interesting thing to kind of try to grapple with in my novel.
Yeah. Well, and it is grappling. And, you know, that very idea that, you know, why aren't you making the decisions I would make for you?
Mm.
You know,
oh, very much so. There's a lot of expectation. You really know how to live their life better than anybody's life. Your family members, yes, you're the expert on what they're doing wrong, that's for sure.
Listen to us online, on your phone, download a podcast, or on your tablet. Radio Gorgeous, there for you.
I want to turn now to your writing, because you have written for some of the best, funniest television shows that, you know, we know. Ellen, Arrested Development, fabulous. But that's usually with other people. So what was that transition like for you, writing on your own?
It was weirdly easy natural, which, you know, it's very hard for me to make sense of, but the way that I've kind of made sense of it is that I think I really am a novelist who kind of had the wrong career for many years. Even though I did well in the wrong career, I feel like my nature is I have a very solitary nature. I really want to be alone, and I think better when I'm alone. And a friend of mine once said that her shrink described her as an introvert disguised as an extrovert. And I thought, oh, that's me. And so that, I think that for a long time, I think I come off as an extrovert. So, oh, being in a big room with people and bouncing ideas off seemed like the thing that would be good for me. But once I realized, hey, wait, I could be doing this alone in a room all by myself and then be able to take naps when I want. That's really the deciding factor, is that I'm in charge of my own naps. I was like, that's the life for me.
Excellent. Well, I think there's something to the fact that you've argued enough with other people to get to your point where you're like, okay, I got this. I can do this alone. I often do, and I'm going to be better at it. And as you say, take my own naps.
That's right. And I didn't kind of realize that I had such a strong voice, you know, until I just started writing novels, because it's always collaborative and you're always kind of almost every line in a script, you know, in TV is the result of other people, you know, pitching in. And so I never even had the chance to know what I was like and what my voice was like. And so once I kind of realized, okay, I can tap into this thing pretty easily and it was fun, then why go back?
And frogs, tell me about amphibian love.
Yes, well, my boyfriend and I, George, are crazy about frogs. And way before people knew what global warming was, we read a book called The Mystery of the Disappearing Frog or something. And it was just about how frogs that used to be everywhere were kind of weirdly disappearing. And so we learned about it and then started giving little checks, you know, before we really had any money, just we'd get our paychecks and then anything extra we would give to this group of scientists who would count frogs who are going around doing this global amphibian assessment. And that ended up being very important work. It turned into global warming, about just kind of, you know, assessing declining numbers of species and things. And frogs are kind of the canary in the coal mine for global warming.
Sensitive.
Exactly, yeah. Because they need moisture and an exact amount of moisture, and even like one less drop of rain could be the difference between them living and dying. And so we just got very, they're just so cute and we love them, and they were kind of going away, and they're not really the sexiest of animals. They're not like pandas or monkeys that everyone, you know, starts crying and weeping over. And they seemed like just kind of this forgotten species, or they're going extinct at alarming rates. I mean, it's really scary. And so we just kind of have been really committed to this cause. And one of the amphibian groups named a frog after our daughter when she was born. And we've just been part of this mission for a long time, and will continue to be.
Excellent. Thank you, Maria.
Well, thank you.